It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
What do we believe about food these days? And maybe even more important, how do we behave? How's it changing the way that we behave? Well, fortunately, somebody's helping us answer that question that's looking into what's going on and what our beliefs about food and what our behaviors are about food. I'm really happy to have some folks on today that are directly involved in research, new research that's been conducted by IFIC, which is the International Food Information Council. I want to welcome Dr. Alex Lewin-Zwerding. What do you do there?
I am Vice President for Research and Partnerships, and in that role, I oversee our research and connect IFIC to external partners like public health and nutrition experts, and so happy to be on today. Thank you.
Well, good. Dr. Well, glad to have you, too. And Liz Sanders, what does a Director of Research and Partnerships do?
So I work directly with Alex on a lot of our consumer research. One of my main responsibilities is managing the planning and promotion of our annual food and health survey. And other than that, I work with Alex to help connect us to outside experts and organizations.
How do you decide who you're going to be talking to do a survey like this?
That's a great question. So one of the landmark features of this survey is that it's nationally representative. So we've been running the survey for 12 years now, and each year we've tried to have a respondent pool that's weighted to represent the current demographics of the United States. So age, gender, race, ethnicity, income level, all of that is taken into account.
Do people feel that their health is good, or is it better than it was? What's the general feeling for what their state of health is?
One of the interesting things that we've found, Roger, in this one is that people tend to overestimate their health status, actually. So people, even if they're overweight or obese, have a tendency to rank their health as excellent or very good. And this is a trend that we see year after year where perception of one's health might not match up with reality.
Well, that's kind of surprising to me because it seems like I run into a lot of people that are complaining about their health. but when they answer the survey, they think they generally are pretty good. And in fact, don't you identify it as in some ways they're just saying that they don't feel they have problems?
Yeah, definitely, Roger. We saw that we followed up with those respondents who said that they were in very good health and asked, what does being in good health mean to you? And it was generally defined by the lack of health problems. And that's also something we know from previous years is that although, you know, risk factors for health problems like BMI don't correlate with perceived health status, that we see people tend to rank their health status as poor when they start reporting that they're being treated for chronic disease such as diabetes or heart disease.
How do they view what makes a food healthy?
Yeah, so this is definitely a really hot topic right now as the FDA reexamines their guidelines for how this term healthy is used in food labeling. So this is definitely something that we wanted to tackle in this year's survey. And we found that overall when consumers think about healthy foods, the top attribute of a healthy food for them is that it's high in healthy components or nutrients. And we know that from our other research and from other questions in this year's survey that they tend to see nutrients like vitamin D, vitamin A, and also commonly perceived as healthy components like whole grains, protein, fiber, that these are the healthy components that they're talking about when they're looking for a healthy food.
You know, one thing that surprised me is that you had people responding that if they had two products had exactly the same nutrition, but two different products, they'd have a different perception of one being healthy versus not healthy. And the one that really stands out is fresh food versus canned food, that even if it had exactly the same components, people assume that the fresh food is healthier.
Yeah, this is so fascinating. We're not the only ones to call something an attribute of a food or a product as having a health halo, but it really fits what's happening here. So as you mentioned, you know, in this survey what we did is give individuals the same nutrition facts panel, so the identical nutrition information, and then ask them to compare which types of products were healthier based on that same nutrition facts panel. And what we see is clear, that the definition of health or healthy extends far beyond a nutritional label. And so there's health halos that surround certain attributes of a food. And as you can see from one of the graphics that we shared as part of the report, there's a real strong health halo around fresh when we're comparing that same product that's fresh to canned or frozen products. There's also a health halo around a food that might have a shorter list of ingredients compared to a longer list. Even foods that are purchased at a natural food store compared to that same food purchased at a convenience store, a more expensive product compared to a cheaper product, and then again and lastly, a name brand product compared to a generic product, that name brand product has a slightly stronger health halo associated with it than the generic brand. So, you know, I think the takeaway from this is that when we're thinking about what factors drive purchasing patterns as it relates to health, we need to think about consumers' perceptions of these factors beyond nutrition.
I think that one interesting data point that we had from last year that just kind of illustrates this point in a snapshot form is that we asked consumers to rank the healthfulness of vitamin C and ascorbic acid, and found that vitamin C was, you know, far and away ranked as very, very healthful, whereas ascorbic acid was only ranked as healthful by about maybe a quarter of the respondents. So that just shows that, you know, the ingredient names really do matter in terms of being able to perceive this healthfulness.
What are the motivators? What drive these people towards these healthy habits? What are the big things that make people, you know, be more motivated toward trying to improve the healthfulness of their diet?
Yeah, and this is definitely something we've tracked over the years. We find that typically it's the internal motivators, the concept of wanting to lose, like you yourself wanting to lose weight, or you yourself wanting to protect your health from long-term conditions. These are the most potent motivators for keeping people on track with healthy eating behaviors that we find. And so they outrank motivators like a conversation with a healthcare professional or a conversation with a friend or family member. Oh, I was just going to say, I think this connects to one of the main healthy eating behaviors that we probe in the survey, and that's that we find that people are really into this idea of making a lot of small changes rather than big diet overhauls. So I think that the fact that fewer people are following these like specific prescribed diets shows this move towards more personalization, towards more small changes that I know a lot of registered dietitians and health professionals can really get behind.
Anything surprise you of what you've learned on how nutrition information is being used at restaurants?
You know, that's a great question, Roger. And I think one of the most surprising findings from this study was the disparity in what consumers are seeking out on packages or products and then what they're seeking out at restaurants. And one of the data points that we like to talk about are that consumers are regularly seeking on package labels such as things like no added hormones or steroids or natural foods or raised without antibiotics, pesticide-free, the list goes on, non-GMO, organic, et cetera. But when it comes to eating at restaurants, consumers are actually a lot less likely to seek out those types of labels. And when we ask consumers, do you seek out any of these factors, such as the ones that I just named, or none of the above, nearly half said none of the above. So there's clearly something going on that's different in a consumer's mind when they're shopping at a supermarket, say, versus going out to eat at a restaurant.
Do you think it's because they're splurging a little bit when they go to a restaurant, or they're treating themselves, or it's been a tough day, I have nothing I can cook for supper tonight, let's go out, and I don't want to worry about it? Do you think that's a factor?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think for a number of consumers, it's seen as a special occasion. It might also be the type of information that's available. So we know that there tends to be quite a bit more information on packages or products than there is on menus. And so it just might also be, to some extent, consumers' expectations of the type of information they can find.
Well, when they're trying to figure out the right thing to do or the right foods to choose, whether they're going out to eat or buying at home, I mean, who do they trust?
So we find that overwhelmingly when it comes to trust, consumers tend to put their trust in healthcare professionals and registered dietitians. So these kind of traditional sources who are typically viewed as experts. Then when it comes to who consumers most frequently rely on for information on what types of food to avoid, this is where it changes a little bit. Because we see that one of the most frequently relied upon sources is personal healthcare professionals. So we know that they're getting a lot of information from this trusted source. But we also see that consumers are getting a lot of information from their friends or their family. And we know that friends and family aren't always as trusted as some of these credentialed sources.
But one of the things that we can say from this research is just how influential friends and family are in different aspects of our diet. We know that friends and family greatly influence their diet choice. So we found that 1 in 3 select an eating pattern or diet based on information from friends and family. And then that trend continues for different aspects of our diet. So friends and family not only drive diet choice, but they also drive our opinion on sweeteners and added sugars. And then they also influence our concerns around food safety.
You know, you have one part of this report where you do focus this on this particular. I'm looking at the slides right now. We're going to tell people that they can see your entire survey online, and you make available actually the whole PowerPoint presentation. And I see this one, I think it was slide number 30, but it's called News, Family, and Friends Influence Safety Concerns. What I find interesting about this particular slide is it kind of varies on the issue, and you've rated the kinds of concerns and then where they get the information that raise the concerns. And I was very surprised that there's at how much detail you've got on that. I wonder if you might talk about that a little bit, because you identify what's the source of influence. They differ a little bit, don't they? In some cases, the family seems to be the most important spot, and others, it might be the news that are the most important.
Yeah, I think that and just for all of our reference, we use the same list for these potential sources for influential information on food safety concerns as we did for sources of information on what foods to eat or avoid. So it was really interesting to compare the sources that were influencing people's opinion about food safety to the sources that were influencing people's opinion about nutrition. And we found that when it came to food safety, although there was a variety of sources that were influential based on the concerns, there was a little bit of a trend forming where we saw that news articles, scientific studies, items that we see frequently in the media tended to influence opinion on food safety more than they did on just general information about what to eat or avoid. Interestingly, besides the news articles and the scientific studies, friends and family kind of stood out because this is more information that you get from those around you and from your social circle than in the media. But interestingly, we weren't seeing health professionals or dietitians as top sources that influenced opinion on food safety.
Well, you know, the other thing that really got my attention is that if you look at the top concerns that consumers have, and you ranked them, you identified foodborne illness, carcinogens, chemicals in food, pesticides, food additives, ingredients, animal antibiotics, biotech, GMOs, and allergens. A lot of those have to do with some production farming practices, like animal antibiotics, for example, or pesticide use, maybe even chemicals. And actually, carcinogens could be from some of those things, some of the pesticides, perhaps. Foodborne illnesses, we can get E. coli, salmonella, and so forth. So a lot of the worries are touched at the farm level.
Yeah, Roger, that's a great point. And I think, you know, one of the things to underscore as a result of this survey is not only are factors beyond nutrition part of how we perceive healthfulness, but factors beyond nutrition are just important in terms of our food values. And one of the things that we found was that sustainability as a whole is important for about half of the consumers we surveyed. And we're seeing that trend hold over time. And if we drill down into sustainability, that's when we get to some of those points that you were just talking about. So looking at the long list of aspects of sustainability that we asked consumers to rank, among those who saw sustainability as important, two that stood out were reducing the amount of pesticides used to produce food and also conserving the natural habitat. So generally thinking about chemical usage and then also environmental issues were the two primary pieces of sustainability that were important to consumers.
You know, it's hard to even ask questions about sustainability, though, because, you know, it just seems like we've been talking sustainability for 5-10 years maybe now, and yet it's still something that people struggle with to try to clarify what that means to them. I mean, often, like you mentioned, it comes up with pesticide use, for example. But I'm curious, as you've done this research and you see sustainability popping up as important to people in their food choices, how does that work out on the demographics? Maybe this is where we can start going back to how you've put together the people that your survey, because you have millennials and you have boomers who are largely seniors or becoming seniors now and everything in between. Do you see variations in whether you're, you know, millennials or boomers? And
that's a great question, Roger. And we do see a lot of subgroup differences among a lot of different aspects of sustainability. I think the biggest one related to sustainability in general is that it's way more important, it's a way more important factor in food purchasing for women than for men. So 56% of women care about...
Why would women be more attuned to sustainability than men? Do you have a theory on that?
Well, I think something we've realized from our survey over the years is that women are more attuned in general to both nutrition, food safety, and sustainability concerns.
Well, do they still tend to do more of the shopping? More and more men are shopping, but the food choices are still skewed towards women, are they not?
They are, yeah. They tend to skew more towards women, and as Liz mentioned, there are several studies that sort of underscore the point that women tend to look at labels and make more careful decisions when it comes to nutrition and healthy eating. We see that hold true in this study for also things like artificial ingredients. If we're asking individuals if they're going to choose one of two foods, one which has artificial ingredients but it tastes great, and the other one having no artificial ingredients but it doesn't taste as good, which one would you choose? If you look at all consumers, it's pretty split, but then when you divide it up by gender, you see that women are more likely to choose the product that has no artificial ingredients but tastes better and doesn't taste as good, and men are more likely to choose the product that tastes better but might have artificial ingredients in it.
Whether it skews a little more towards women than men, though, it's still pretty important that you're running, you say, nearly half that are concerned about sustainability?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, over half for women this year.
Over half of the women. And do you remember what percentage of men?
It was about 42%.
Okay,
so under half.
It's still pretty significant. It's still pretty significant. You've got a sustainable product that's high sustainability. It should be an advantage to you, to a significant share of the population. But it's tough to tell those stories. I mean, if all you've got is a label of a product or on a menu, again, this may not be covered in the research per se, but is there anything you've observed that how people are or companies are trying to communicate the sustainability of their product or of the ingredient?
Well, what we know, Roger, from this research and that I think is interesting to a range of food companies is how individualized definitions become. And so sustainability, as we know from this, means different things to different people, and different attributes of sustainability are more or less important. And so as we know, too, nutrition is becoming more and more individualized. So how do we appeal to the personalized shopper might have a different definition about sustainability from someone one aisle over? And we see that play out with different types of labels and themes. And the other one that I wanted to highlight was our individualized definition of processed food. And I thought this was particularly interesting finding from our study this year when we asked consumers, what do you consider to be processed? And we gave them a whole long list of different carrot products, from carrot cake that was bought in the store to baby food carrots to canned carrots to carrot juice. And we see that factors like whether something was store-bought versus homemade, whether it's boxed or not, whether it's organic or not, all affect our very individualized and personal definitions of what we consider to be a processed food. And one of the most interesting stats sort of within that is that bagged baby carrots were seen as twice as likely to be processed compared to that same bagged baby carrots, but organic. And so if you're a food company thinking about what does processed mean to the consumer, it means a range of things. And so it is confusing as we navigate the landscape to think about what are consumers asking for and how do we appeal to them at the same time ensuring that they can make healthy choices more easily.
Well, can you back up on that difference that you were just explaining again about the organic? What was what was that point of, say, baby carrots that are, you know, just baby carrots normally versus baby carrots that are organic and how they're perceived?
Yeah, so sure. We asked consumers, what do consumers consider to be processed? And that the actual question was, which of the options below would you consider to be processed foods? And like I mentioned, we gave them a whole long list of carrot-related products so that we could easily compare. And of those products, two of them were bagged baby carrots and organic bagged baby carrots. And double the number of consumers thought that bagged baby carrots would be processed or defined as processed compared to the same product but organic.
Oh, no, that really is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, we thought so.
yeah. And now, was there any difference between the demographics?
I think we saw, at least in terms of the definition of processed foods, that it tended to be pretty similar across the board when it came to age demographics.
Now, what would happen had you put non-GMO baby carrots instead of organic? Because there's somewhere else I saw in your research that it was non-GMO and organic ranked closer together as far as a perception of a label description than I thought they might. But you haven't any feel of what if you had used something like non-GMO in the, whether that would have changed the way people responded to the processed or not question?
I think that's an interesting question and definitely a different way that we could have come at it. One way that we did assess organic versus non-GMO was we asked which of these labels do you regularly seek out on packages or at restaurants? And we found that organic and non-GMO ranked pretty similarly in terms of labels that consumers are seeking out on packages and at restaurants. One thing that was interesting about this question, though, is that there were major subgroup differences for millennials, Gen Xs, and boomers. We saw that millennials were way more likely to seek out organic products than the older generations.
What about vegan products or vegetarian products? Was that skewed more highly towards millennials or not?
So we didn't ask about vegan or vegetarian specifically, but there is a really interesting point about the healthfulness of animal protein versus plant protein among the generations. So we found that millennials were much more likely to say that animal protein is healthier compared to those 65 plus.
Isn't
so we
that,
see that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think we just really see that that kind of paleo pro animal protein stance coming across in those younger generations, where those trends haven't maybe hit the 65 plus yet.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, that's kind of counterintuitive because I think most people would guess that perhaps they've just been used to forever thinking that younger people might be more likely to be vegetarian than older people. But you're kind of hitting a different stage of the trend, or maybe where you're hitting boomers that perhaps are cutting back or watching that they're not eating as much cheese as they used to or something like that. But to see such a higher percentage among millennials that are accepting of animal products is not what most people would guess.
I think it's interesting, Roger, if we think about it in the context of desired health benefits and as it changes over age. And we asked individuals which of the following, and we gave them a list, health benefits are you most interested in getting from food or nutrients? And by and large, weight loss or weight management was the number one benefit that individuals sought. Next in line was cardiovascular health and then energy and digestive health. And as we think about it from an age perspective, as individuals age, we see weight become less important compared to some other factors. And so that's, you know, due to dietary needs changing as we age and maybe other issues, health issues and health conditions like our cardiovascular health becoming more front and center in our lives and seeming more real. And so the question then becomes, how do we think about those concerns and those desired benefits as it relates to our eating patterns?
So if somebody raises animals and has products from animals, maybe they're heartened by the fact that you're showing a better inclination towards animal products than might have been expected.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the next step are the kinds of surveys that are available or research that's available through some of the retailer organizations where they are seeing what people actual purchase. So you can have somebody say, I always eat healthy, but when you see their frequent shopper survey information, you might find that they're filling their shopping cart with Twinkies, if Twinkies still exist. I suppose there is that factor in a survey like this, that there are some people that exaggerate. Is there any way for you to factor in the expected level of exaggeration?
Yeah, it's certainly a limitation of these types of studies when we're asking people to self-report. What we do see is consistency in trends over time, so that's definitely a good window for us to see how issues are tracking. And again, this survey tells us a lot more, I think, than just what people eat, but it tells us what people care about. And that's a big part of how we can use the findings from this to inform different types of nutrition education efforts. It also tells us about levels of food confusion and food doubt. If we go back and think about weight loss as the most desired benefit, we see that over half of survey respondents couldn't name a single food or nutrient associated with that benefit. So although people do tend to inflate the healthfulness of their diets, I think this survey dives a lot deeper in terms of assessing attitudes and perceptions around health.
Overall, it won't surprise most people to know that taste is a number one driver. And number two, then, is price. And then number three is helpfulness. Number four is convenience. You've added another category now, and sustainability is right there. And for those that are saying, well, nothing really changes because we know that, you know, taste and price have always been number one, I think, to my mind, one big change over the last 5 or 10 years is healthfulness over convenience. I think that there has been a shift that healthfulness has been moving up. And then the other one is adding sustainability at all, because a few years ago that wouldn't have even been on a top list anywhere close to these others. And the fact that you've got sustainability in there. And you also are adding checking for how people feel about brand. I mean, could you explain that a little bit? Because I understand these other five now, taste, price, helpfulness, convenience, sustainability. How did brand make the list for trying to probe its role in driving demand?
So I think that you ask a lot of good questions there. Sustainability, that is one that we've seen kind of ebb and flow since 2012. But if you look at it, when we started asking about sustainability in 2012 as a purchasing factor, we saw that it affected more of about a third of consumers, and now it's up around 40%. So we do see that kind of gradual trend upward over time with sustainability. I think when you're asking about healthfulness and its relative importance as a purchasing factor, that is one that actually has interesting subgroup differences. We know that healthfulness is really up there in terms of importance for the ages 50-plus subgroup.
Well, I tell you, it's a fascinating study. I want to congratulate you on you know, producing this. So what are a couple of your favorite findings or learnings from this survey?
Thanks, Roger. I think that's my favorite question so far. You know, one of the most interesting findings to us is who people are relying on for information. I think Liz talked about earlier great reliance on friends and family, but the low trust we have in them. And so the question then becomes, you know, how do we empower those individuals that are credible and then arm individuals that need some additional nutrition education if they're going to be dispensing it. And so there is that dichotomy there in terms of trust and reliance. And then that feeds into the larger point, I think, from a lot of this survey, which is just how much consumers are doubting the choices that they're making. And so they are receiving a lot of conflicting information, receiving information from lots of sources, and then at the end of the day, largely doubting the choices that they're making and not understanding what's healthy and what's not. And so our role is to communicate the science, of course, and these types of studies really help us make sense of where the gaps are.
Yeah, and I think just piggybacking on Alex's point, as a dietitian, I was really surprised to see that nutrition facts panel and the nutritional content of a food was only one factor that went into people's perceptions of the healthfulness of that food. So I think that was a really surprising and interesting finding to me, and it really went along with everything that Alex was saying about how all this conflicting nutrition information is really driving these health halos around certain foods.
Any ideas on what happens next? How does the rubber hit the road here?
Well, of course, we do this survey year after year, so we're able to adjust our research to fill in some of the gaps that we identify and drill down on some of the emerging issues. One of our main goals with the survey is to make sure that the findings get out into the public, and so they're freely available on our site and hopefully used by consumers, health professionals, dietitians, and others who can take the findings and use them in their materials to further educate consumers about nutrition education. We've also worked closely with government agencies like USDA to help better understand how consumers think about and use and understand MyPlate and the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and just align our messaging so that we're consistent and can understand where those gaps are and seek to fill them through our programs going forward.
Well, there's a lot of great information there, and I'm glad you mentioned MyPlate, because people can check online for USDA and look for MyPlate.
It's choosemyplate.gov.
Oh, okay. One of my takeaways is that sustainability is not going away. It's coming up in different ways, the levels of interest. It's kind of fascinating because, again, it's going to be hard to tell all these stories. But it's good, I think, people want to understand the production practices that are being used, and there's going to be lots of opportunities to get those stories told. How you fit it all on a label or get it to a website or a blog or in people's hands so they can use it, that becomes part of the decision-making in addition to the taste and the price and the healthfulness and the convenience. Whether or not the foods are produced and processed sustainably, it sounds to me like you're in the right profession to be in the information business, because we've got needs for lots of information and needs to get it out there in different forms. And this is one form, talking about it on the podcast. And I really appreciate your taking the time. Now, you know, we're glad we've been talking to Dr. Alex Zwerding and also to Liz Sanders with International Food Information Council, IFIC. And I believe they can find you online.
Foodinsight.org.
See, I have to ask these questions. I would have gotten it all wrong. So foodinsight.org. Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.